I'm Brian Karam, and I've spent decades covering politics. Now I'm taking you behind the scenes, one interview at a time.
Join us as each week Brian confronts the issues that matter, posing the questions you wish you could ask. No filter, no agenda, just the truth.
We're not here for sound bites. We're here for substance. Join me, Brian Karam, every week as we cut through the noise and get straight to it. This is Just Ask the Question, where curiosity will lead us to the facts.
Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform. And remember, when you want answers, all you have to do is just ask the question.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isgoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
And welcome to another edition of the Spy Talk podcast. Our guest this week is Jake Tapper, the astute and sometimes controversial CNN news host, who's known for his tough interviewing style and rapid fact-checking abilities. But today he's here to talk with us about his latest book, Race Against Terror, a fast-paced police procedural style account of the apprehension and groundbreaking trial of an Al-Qaeda terrorist who washed up in Italy as a refugee back in 2011. First, though, per usual, Mike, Karen, and I have a few items of interest in our corner of the world to discuss, the biggest of which has to be the bizarre, to me, indictment of former FBI Director James Comey on charges of lying to Congress. Mike, what's going on here? It stinks of politics.
This is Exhibit A of the weaponization of law enforcement by the Trump administration. I mean, look, James Comey is a controversial figure in and of itself. He made a lot of calls and a lot of decisions that have been legitimately questioned. He was arguably a little too overzealous at times. And he's been chastised by the Inspector General of the Justice Department quite harshly, as a matter of fact. But that said, I mean, this indictment is, it's the skimpiest indictment I've ever seen. And so much so that Pat Fitzgerald, his lawyer today during the arraignment, said, we don't even know who he is supposed to have lied about and what about. We'd have no idea what stories were leaked as a result of Jim Comey supposedly authorizing leaks. It is all absent. And, you know, look, the judge set an early trial date of January 5th, which is really quick for a criminal trial of especially of a high profile defendant. But, you know, the people I talk to say the likelihood is this is never going to go to trial at all, that Pat Fitzgerald is going to file multiple motions to dismiss this for vindictive prosecution, selective prosecution, questioning whether Lindsey Halligan, the recently installed U.S. attorney, the former insurance lawyer, personal lawyer for Donald Trump, was even eligible to be U.S. attorney. So there are multiple ways for this to go away. But the fact that it was brought in the first place is really a stunning case of politicization of law enforcement.
Yeah. On the other hand, they've been threatening, the White House has been threatening to go after people that they feel have either betrayed them or been their enemies in the past. So the real question is, no, this is not just a case about Comey in and of himself. This is a case about what powers they have should they want to go after others. And so it's actually very important. And the fact that there are so few details in the indictment so that we really don't even know what they're talking about. So how do you mount a case against it when you haven't given the details of what you've been charged with? The fact that they're willing to use the justice system in a way that really contravenes so much of the exquisitely detailed work that you expect in an indictment and a way things will play out in court is really problematic. And so the question is, can the courts find a way to push back against an abuse of the norms and the regulations that go to this trial?
And I just want to add one more point about how skimpy this indictment was and devoid. You know, Pat Fitzgerald, Comey's lawyer, did a false statements case. He was appointed by the then Deputy Attorney General of the Justice Department, James Comey, to be the independent counsel in the Scooter Libby case, the leak of Valerie Plame, the former CIA operative whose name was leaked by people in the Bush administration. And, you know, when Fitzgerald brought that indictment, he had a mountain of facts to back it up, something like 8 or 9 people who could put Scooter Libby in the room knowing what he denied knowing to the grand jury. He had multiple ways to prove it, including he could identify which reporter Scooter Libby talked to, Judy Miller of the New York Times, what he told that reporter. There was abundant evidence, and that is totally lacking in this case.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because the idea that this is Pat Fitzgerald, I mean, for people who have paid attention to the criminal justice system at its highest level over recent decades, before he went into private practice, Pat Fitzgerald is one of those names at the very top, not just for terrorism cases, which I follow, for a lot of other cases. And knowing what a prosecutor does and how a prosecutor does things is just entrenched in who he is and who he's been. And so this is, you know, the right person for the job, and we'll see how this plays out. But it's very much, to your point, sort of the old system versus what's happening now, the customary traditional system versus what's happening now. And it really matters.
Yeah. And we need to keep in mind, it can't be said often enough, that none of the prosecutors in that office would issue an indictment, and they quit or were fired. So, I mean, the case just stinks from high heaven. But and the judge is going to play an important role here, of course, as judges often do. And what I've read about this judge, he doesn't have a high tolerance for nonsense. So
yeah,
he's going
to
be
receptive. I
wonder
how he took it when one of those newly brought in prosecutors they had, because they couldn't find anybody inside the office to do it, then had to get up and say, well, you know, Judge, I'm new and I'm not really familiar with the evidence in this case.
They couldn't even find prosecutors in Virginia. They had to go to North Carolina. Oh, my God.
Not a good way to start before a federal judge when the prosecutor says, I don't really know what I'm prosecuting here.
So this is the legal side of the
amateur hour
of the national national security state and the state of the national security state, and it stinks. So anyway, here's a couple things annoying me this week. One, it's just come out, it was reported by the Washington Post, that a quarter of FBI agents are assigned to immigration enforcement. This takes them off cyber crimes, drug trafficking, terrorism, counterintelligence, and more. The statistics are from the Bureau itself, so they can't really lie about it. Although, since the statistics are from the FBI itself, this may be a low ball. There may be more than a quarter of FBI agents assigned to immigration.
I was talking to an FBI source just today who pointed out to me that the counterterrorism fly team has lost 20% of its staff in the last few weeks, few months anyway. And this is, by the way, a pretty important team. These were the guys who flew over to Pakistan to arrest the Abbey Gate bomber. One of the most high-profile terrorism cases that the Justice Department is bringing right now. And the prosecutor in charge of that case in the Eastern District of Virginia, as we'll hear from Jake Tapper, has recently been fired as well. So the FBI agents who make the arrest get moved off, and the chief prosecutor gets cashier.
Right. And it's not to be taken lightly, because the idea is, can they make the nation secure? But can they also make the people and the citizens of the country safe? And so the question is, what's happening with this depletion of FBI sources for things that they normally are trained to take care of and protect against? And it's incredibly worrisome. And the question, you know, where are the inspector generals? We know what happened to them. Where is the oversight? We just
saw oversight this week with Pam Bondi.
But it's serious.
Insulting the senators, insulting her.
Exactly. It was a travesty. It was ridiculous. Absurd.
Anyway.
Yeah, you got to wonder who's minding the counterterrorism store. You know, these are very complex investigations, as anybody even watching a movie about it would know, and dealing with, you know, confidential sources and so on. And so, and that goes double for counterintelligence investigations in which you're trying to stop, let's say, Chinese and Russian infiltration of U.S. security agencies, and particularly the Pentagon and Pentagon contractors.
We
see case after case that's been brought. You got to wonder what's going on with these cases now.
But it's also about institutional history. It's also about what does a certain name mean? What does a certain location mean? What does a certain group mean? And if you get rid of the people that have that institutional knowledge, that have devoted their careers to understanding who, what, when, where, and why, you really are compromised. And it's very worrisome.
For sure. Yeah. And finally, another itch under my saddle is the looming polygraph campaign against DOD employees. This is the Hegseth polygraph campaign, and Tulsi Gabbard is into it, too. I've been writing about the lack of precision, let's put it, of polygraph exams going back to the mid-1990s when I wrote a piece in the New York Times about an NSA polygraph investigation looking for leakers, and it had came up with false results, charging, you know, accusing people of leaking who weren't leaking. And of course, a very practiced a leaker or foreign agent can defeat the polygraph. In fact, you can look it up. You can Google how to defeat a polygraph, and they'll tell you how to do it. And one of the most notorious spies in the history of America, Aldrich Ames, CIA officer, he beats polygraph a couple times, you know, biting your tongue and squeezing your toes and this and that. So, you know, this is a waste of time and money, and further, you know, erodes the morale in the Pentagon and the department wide. And it's just no good for national security. So that's on my mind this week. But back to Jake Tapper. Of course, our listeners know him mostly as the CNN host and presidential debate moderator, but he's also well-regarded, actually often highly praised, and prolific author of both fiction and nonfiction, the latest of which is Race Against Terror, which may sound kind of wonky, but is actually kind of a true crime detective story and courtroom thriller. And we are delighted he took out time from his very busy schedule to talk with us today. So we'll be back with Jake Tapper after these messages. Jake Tapper, welcome to Spy Talk. It's great to have you here.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
And great to talk about your great new book, Race Against Terror, which I found absolutely fascinating. I didn't expect to, I have to say. Decades-old terrorism case. I thought, I've had enough terrorism cases. I've had enough Guantanamo, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, but I got drawn in, and I was fascinated. You're a good writer.
Thank you.
As I know from reading your novels. And we exchanged a note or two about those in past years. So you're a terrific writer. And so I invite anyone who's even mildly interested in the subject to pick up this book, and you'll find that it draws you in and kind of captures you for a long time. And it's a serious book as well. But before we get on to your book, I have to ask you, you know, I've seen reports of death threats to you. What's going on with that right now?
I mean, I don't know if there's more death threats than normal. Maybe I need to Google myself. It's a fraught time. It's a fraught time to be in journalism. It's a fraught time to be in journalism and not part of one of the teams, not a Democrat, not a Republican. I think that this is probably a group that understands that better than most. It's also not a particularly fun time to be a Jew in American public life. So I'm not sure which death threat you're referring to, but it's been a rough few years. And I think everybody whose face I'm looking at right now knows what I'm talking about in terms of not being perceived as a Democrat or a Republican. That means you don't have a built-in team rooting for you, defending you, protecting you, and also, you know, having a last name like Tapper, Stein, Greenberg, or Isikoff like, can also bring some unwanted attention from people who assume that you feel certain ways about activities going on the other side of the world that you might maybe don't feel that way.
Yeah. Fraught time indeed.
Well, We definitely want to talk about Race Against Terror, which raises all sorts of interesting questions.
We need to disclose, Mike, that it is 16 years ago, I ran into you in the lobby of Sibley Hospital when my son was being born. And your son was being born. So I just
Jack
and Zach.
Jack and Zach. And literally, we just celebrated Jack's 16th birthday a couple days ago. So anyway, that's all. Sorry. Mike always reminds me of a very joyous time of my life.
Our birthday party was the Commander's game with a bunch of his buddies, and they all went crazy. And it was very successful. Okay, here's my threshold question. You know, you're on TV every day. You write these novels. You do these posts on social media. You write best-selling, you know, books about Biden, and then now you have this. I want you to address the conspiracy theory that there are multiple AI-driven Jack Taper bots that are producing all this stuff.
No, so this
and,
book,
and if that's the case, which Jake Tapper do we have here today on the pod?
So this book, Race Against Terror, I started 3 years ago. And it was actually at Jack's birthday. We were doing a paintball birthday. It was out in the middle of nowhere. And so because it was so far away, I just had adults stay for pizza and refreshments on their own. And one of the dads came up to me and said he knew somebody from my book, The Outpost. And I said, yeah, the military keeps such horrible records and they don't share them. That was really tough to write. And then he is one of the main characters in this book, Race Against Terror. So I finished writing this book 2 years ago. And then I'd spent the 6 months after that, you know, editing and fact checking. But it was done and had been done before I started writing the Biden book, which we obviously rushed into production because we wanted to get it out there as soon as possible, so that there is an explanation for it.
Do you think you'll have a book on Trump state of mind and health and how the administration is protecting him from obvious cognitive decline?
Well, we're only 9 months into it, so it's a little early to say. I look forward to reading. I know Maggie Haberman and Jonathan Swan are working on a book right now about Trump's first year. So, I mean, I wrote the Biden book because I wanted to read a book that explained what happened and nobody was writing it. So I said, okay, Alex, let's you and I write it. If after the end of 4 years of Trump, there it does not exist a book that has gone into what's going on with this president's state of mind, and he's 79 now and et cetera, et cetera. Sure, maybe. But like, I have a feeling that we might already have some books that do that by then. But if not, my mind's open for sure.
Yeah, not much of it is hidden, I must say, watching
That's
his
the other
performance
thing.
Every day.
He's not hiding. There's no one's hiding anything. He's saying all these wild, false things and confusing this and that and lying. And it's all right out there, you know.
You're going to get more threats. Anyway, let's get back to Race Against Terror. You said upon this conversation you had at the paintball birthday party, you were immediately taken by the story and fascinated by it. I understand after reading the book why you were, but in your own words, what was it that immediately captured you?
So what was so fascinating to me was the sleuthing of it all. You guys know this because this is what you write day in, day out. But generally speaking, when I cover trials or I have reporters on my show to cover trials, it's the case is being presented or it has been presented. And there isn't very much explanation as to how that evidence came forward. The spy talk, as it were, the accumulation of evidence. What happened in the story when Bitkauer told me the story, Dave Bitkauer, who is the assistant U.S. attorney and one of the main characters, and also my son Jack's friend's Max's dad. When Max's dad told me the story, it starts off on the deck of this Italian cruise ship during the Arab Spring on the Mediterranean, where a 5'6" man from Africa asks an Italian Green Beret for some water. He gives him the water. He sees he has a bullet wound scar, asks him how he got it. The guy says, I got it fighting Americans in Afghanistan. I'm in Al-Qaeda. I don't belong with these refugees. That's who's on the ship. And from there, he confesses. And the Americans have a choice. Do they try to prove that his confession is true, his confession of killing Americans in an ambush in Afghanistan in 2003, trying to blow up the U.S. embassy in Nigeria a few years later. Do they try to prove that to be true and try him for his crimes? Or do they let the Italians just deal with him, and the Italians will probably just let him go in a refugee camp and he'll escape, and he's very determined to kill as many Americans as possible.
So why did he confess?
There are two reasons, I think. One is he had been in a Libyan prison for several years where he'd been tortured, and I think his mind wasn't fully the same after that. I don't think anybody's would be. He had been taken by Gaddafi's stooges from the prison during the Arab Spring when the Gaddafi regime was falling. They would, as you know, like empty the prisons and try to send them all to Europe. And Gaddafi made this threat very, very loudly that you support the Arab Spring against me, I'm going to send these jihadists to Europe to kill all of you. So that's one. I think he was just dealing with being free and, you know, having been traumatized in prison. The other thing, and this is an interesting story, it's not in the book. So Bitkauer went to Yale, and Bitkauer, when he was at Yale, interviewed Ron Darling for the Yale Daily News. Ron Darling, the pitcher for the New York Mets. He won a World Series, et cetera, a huge baseball star. But when Bitkauer interviewed him, he wanted to talk to him about this no-hitter he pitched in college. And Ron Darling remembered every single detail about that day, even though he'd gone on to win a World Series. And this is just Yale baseball. Who cares? But he remembered every detail. And to Bitkauer, Spin Ghoul, this terrorist, talking about his greatest achievements as a terrorist, reminded him of Ron Darling remembering that he pitched that no-hitter.
That's a stretch.
But it was the mind of somebody talking about a day that they can't forget because they're so proud of it.
Yep.
And yeah, it's not the same thing as Ron Darling pitching a no-hitter, but it is the mind of a jihadist who is really proud of his work in terrorism. So I think that's why. And as you know, he later stopped cooperating. And whether that was because he realized he shouldn't have cooperated to begin with, or whether he was going nuts, or whether it was what people call the jihad of annoyance, which is like that you're in prison, you're a jihadist, you have no other way to fight the Americans other than just be as annoying as possible. Whatever it was, he stopped cooperating.
So do you know of any other case where a captured Al-Qaeda suspect immediately confessed and expressed pride in killing Americans?
No, I don't. And I don't also, this was the first, and as of now, only a foreign terrorist brought to the United States to be tried in a criminal court for killing American soldiers, service members on a battlefield. It's the first and only time it's happened, though Trump is right now trying to do the second one with Jafar, who was part of the Abbey Gate bombing, allegedly. And that is, I think, a good sign that President Trump, even though he doesn't know he's walking in Obama's footsteps, is learning. Because I do think that there's an argument to be made that if Spin Ghoul had been picked up during the Bush years and had been sent to Gitmo, I think there's an argument to be made, and it's all speculation, of course, but that he ultimately would have been released because they didn't have any evidence against him other than his confession, and he would have gone to Oman or Niger or Saudi Arabia or whatever and tried to kill as many Americans as possible. I mean, I think that is it's a hypothetical that's not difficult to imagine, but because the Americans had all this evidence, they were able to lock him away forever. So I think that's good for Jafar, but as you guys know, Trump is ridding the Justice Department of experienced counterterrorism prosecutors, whether it's George Toscas, who was part of the Spin Ghoul case, who was basically sidelined in January because he signed off on the Mar-a-Lago warrant, or Michael Ben-Ari, who was prosecuting Jafar and was fired from the Eastern District of Virginia last week because some MAGA person said something crazy about him on Twitter. I mean, just that we are ridding and I should note, none of these people have ever talked to me or cooperated with me in any way. I don't consider them like supporters of journalism or national security journalism. They're not. But I know enough to know that their colleagues have reverence and respect for them, and that they help keep us safer just as human beings, not as journalists. They don't help our journalists at work. It seems really bad. It seems like these are decisions making us less safe.
Okay, I just want to take this back a little bit to the trial itself. And can you just run us through, just to set the stage, why, under what conditions, Bengul ended up in the criminal justice system here?
So the Italians have him, and the prosecution has to, in the Eastern District of New York, decides. We should disclose, Karen, that you're in the book and we're a resource for the book, right? I mean, like, do I have to? You're a footnote, and I rely on your research.
I won't criticize anything, I promise.
No, you don't. I'm not trying to butter you up. I'm just saying, like, I relied upon your scholarship for the book.
Thank you for saying that.
And also in the Atlantic piece I wrote last week.
Thank you.
So, I mean, basically, the Americans have a choice. Like, the Italians are saying, we can't hold them much longer. You need to take him, or we're going to put him in a refugee camp, and that's minimum security. He'll walk out, he'll kill Americans. Or the Americans need to prove a case. Now, George Toscas and others are like, you can't just bring him over here. We need to know that you're going to get a conviction. So they start this intense investigation and trying to prove a case for a guy that doesn't even know what month it was when he ambushed the Americans. But little by little, they build this case. They get enough for an indictment. They get enough for an indictment. They get enough to extradite him. He gets brought to the United States. It's hidden from the public for a year.
What are the conditions that the Italians put on
the Italians will only, well, they will not release him to the Americans if he's going to Gitmo, which is already off the table because it's the Obama era. They will not release him if it's a military tribunal. They will not release him if the death penalty is on the table. So the Italians, probably unlike the Pakistanis, I would imagine, with Jafar, the Italians are saying, and the Italians at this point in our history, in the nation's history, are not happy with how America has been waging the so-called war on terror. They have just prosecuted a number of CIA agents for kidnapping an Egyptian cleric at what's called an extraordinary rendition. They are not, and you know, the whatever people who voted for Obama thought of how the world was going to embrace us under Obama as opposed to George W. Bush, that's not how the rest of the world looked at the United States. The United States was the United States. It didn't matter. We don't care if it's Macron or Mitterrand. I mean, like, it's all just France, right? So that's how they looked at us. We don't like the way you've been waging this war on terror. We don't like your war in Iraq. We're not sure about this war in Afghanistan. We don't trust how you're doing these things. So they really set the rules for the conditions under which they would release Bengul into the custody of the United States. But the Americans were pretty much okay with that because it was the Obama era. So they were already on board with the no Gitmo. And Obama did want to show that these people could be tried in criminal courts, even though there was this, it's hard to understand it today when you look back on it, but the pushback from Congress in terms of bringing terrorists to the United States for prosecution, you would think that they had superhuman strength, that they were like Thanos with like lasers coming out of their fingers. Like, you're going to bring Khalid Sheikh Mohammed to the United States and he was just going to be like running through the streets like King Kong. Like, people were still very terrorized after 9/11.
I thought your reconstruction of the political blowback to against Obama and Eric Holder when they tried to do that was pretty interesting. I mean, and brought back a lot of memories for those of us who covered it at the time. But the larger question that your book is dealing with is the tension between criminal court and what first Bush and then Obama tried to do with military commissions, because Obama went along and tried to reform these military commissions, which have proven to be a complete fiasco. I mean, here we are 24 years later after 9/11, and there's no prospect of a 9/11 trial down at Gitmo.
So maybe we should talk about what distinguished, let's just talk about what distinguished the Bengul trial, why we could try him here, as opposed to why we couldn't try the Guantanamo detainees here. Not just the legislation, but what the actual hurdle was that didn't
Was no tainted evidence, right? There was nothing Correct. From anybody taken to a black site. And that was key, even though some of his commanders in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Hadi and Faraj and guys who were at Gitmo, their evidence was tainted. And there's one story that's in the book that takes place in 2002 in Pakistan. It's when the FBI captures Abu Zubaydah. What's interesting about it is when the FBI is in charge of this raid with the Pakistanis, they collect evidence that is deemed admissible in the trial of Spin Ghul. But because right after the FBI gets Abu Zubaydah, the CIA comes in, takes him, whisks him off, takes him to a black site. None of the evidence after that is usable. But because the FBI was doing things the quote unquote right way, that evidence was allowed to be used. And there were questions, and this is where George Toscas came in. There were questions about, well, what happened to him in Libyan custody that might have affected his confession or this and that. But that whatever happened, it wasn't done with the U.S.'s knowledge or participation. Libya was not an ally. So unlike other cases where, you know, the U.S. had taken somebody to a country like Turkey or Egypt and they had tortured somebody, and then that evidence came to the U.S. and then a judge said, that's not admissible. Doesn't matter if it's someone else doing it. We knew, or we were part of it, or we were working with them. That was not deemed inadmissible. And when Spin Ghul was telling his whole story before an Italian courtroom, he was not being tortured at all. And he was read his rights and he was being treated fairly and well, and probably the best he'd been treated in years.
And yet when he's tried, and we talked about these other trials that have sort of started and stopped at Guantanamo, but also in the United States, they're for acts that have already been committed. But what happens with the Spin Ghul trial is it's actually larger than what the battlefield itself. Can you talk a little bit about that, the preventive aspect of the case?
Well, it sounds like I should ask you, honestly, but I mean, he was not only being tried for the ambush, the Al-Qaeda ambush in April 2003, that resulted in 4 service members being seriously wounded and 2 being killed, Ray Lozano and Jared Dennis. He was also being tried for conspiracy to blow up the U.S. embassy in Nigeria, which he was not able to do, but he wanted to do, and he confessed to doing. So it was those two things. But all of the debates that's part of your guys' bread and butter in terms of just like, what about the laws of war? Why isn't he covered under that? And all that becomes part of the story of Spin Ghul, because obviously his defense attorneys, and he had 3 great defense attorneys, all of our faith, interestingly enough. And they, you know, they want to provide the best defense they can for him. One of them is, what about the fact that he was returning fire or firing upon soldiers in a war zone? Why is that against the law? And that is, you know, that is sussed out and argued in pretrial motions.
Hey, that's a good question, by the way. And I walk us through how that was resolved, because, you know, this is not classic terrorism. I mean, he's not targeting civilians, which is the usual definition of of terrorism. The United States invaded Afghanistan. Right. You know, I'm just trying to think of, you know, if people in Gaza being tried for shooting at Israeli soldiers. Most people would say, well, what do you expect? The Israeli soldiers have invaded their country. So just walk us through how that was, the killing of American soldiers was a crime.
So the defense wants to bring this expert, Lieutenant Colonel Frakt, F-R-A-K-T, to allow him to testify, to make this argument. And basically his argument is the American people are now saying that we can go anywhere in the world, our military, and kill anybody that is Al-Qaeda, but if they return fire, that's against the law. That's the argument. And Frakt makes a very compelling argument, and ultimately the judge rejects it. But more along the line, I think he just more, the first of all, the judge was a Bush appointee, we should note, just in terms of his inclinations on this. But it was more because on technical grounds having to do with, I don't need a legal expert to tell me what to do. I'm the judge, and we don't need this guy to testify. And he basically just rejected it. There were other arguments, including Al-Qaeda is not a state, and therefore they don't get law of war protection. They don't wear a uniform, so they are not an identifiable military. But your basic argument that, look, the guy was firing on American service members in a war zone, was not embedding himself within population, was not targeting civilians, Fracht made those arguments. And he thought that it was fair to go after Spingool for conspiracy to blow up the U.S. embassy in Nigeria. He didn't think it was that this part of it was acceptable, but ultimately that argument didn't win. But I mean, one of the things that was interesting about this to me was just to present that as a chapter, just because it is an interesting question. Don't know. One of the great things you know about being a journalist is I don't actually have to know what the right answer is. I just know that these are the questions and they're all interesting and they're for the readers to decide. I guess I'm kind of mixed on it. I understand his argument, but at the same time, you know, Spingool's a bad guy and I want him locked up.
I thought it was fascinating that the judge himself, Judge Kogan, thought it was a show trial. He wondered why Spingool wasn't taken to Gitmo right away.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I was really grateful that Judge Kogan talked to me for the book. That's not common, as you know. Yeah. And it was, he thought his basic argument was like, look, Obama is the president. He can do whatever he wants to do. Like, if he wants to send this guy to Gitmo, he can do it. If he wants to send him to a military commission, he can do it. Like, what is the point of doing this trial to demonstrate that we can try these people according to our ideals? I think he thought it was a bit performative. It was a huge effort. I mean, and it is difficult to imagine this degree of success with every terrorist that the U.S. ever captures. Like, what they did to get, and this is why I thought the book was fun to write and why I was interested in telling the story to begin with, is because the sleuthing of it is just so interesting. And the fact that it all worked in the end, you know, that they actually did find the fingerprint on that book, et cetera, that was just so cool to me. But I also recognize that it's extraordinary. It's an extraordinary story. And not every jihadi that you pick up who said that they killed Americans in Afghanistan 10 years before, are you going to be able to prove the case this effectively?
On the other hand, you make the case that, you know, you talk about the Gailani trial, right? Which is something that I am obsessed with. And you talk about the Gailani trial and sort of, in a way, it put an end to the idea, right? That we were going to try terrorists in the United States, certainly not ones from Gitmo. Do you think this trial and the conviction that was gotten and the way they were able to get the evidence is one of the points of your book that you think it sort of opened up, as you were saying at the very beginning, a lane to try terrorism trials in a way that we sort of gave up on?
I think so. And I think, for people who don't know, Gailani was the first Gitmo detainee tried in American court.
The only Gitmo.
First
detainee.
And only. And he was tried for his involvement in the 1998 embassy bombings. And the judge threw out the best witness, the one who basically was the key to the whole case, because the prosecution had only learned his name through a CIA black site interrogation of Gailani. Mm-hmm. And the jury, to its infinite wisdom, convicted him of one of 285 charges and acquitted him of 284, thus guaranteeing that he would not be freed, but also sending a message to the prosecutors, like, cut the shit, like, that you did not prove your case. So I would love to interview a juror on that. I wonder if it was how I'm interpreting it. But yeah, I mean,
I'm coming with you when you do that.
Absolutely.
I'm coming.
But the idea, so when Jeff Sessions in 2017, so the case starts in 2011, and then the trial is in 2017, the FBI wants to try it again. They want to bring a terrorist from abroad into the United States to try him. And Jeff Sessions says, no, these guys do not get First Amendment, do not get court protections. They do not get constitutional due process. They don't get it. No, he's not happy to hear about the Spingool trial But it's already, that ship has sailed and it's happening and there's nothing he can do about it. But that's the end of that. Now, on the other hand, here we are in Trump 2 and it is going forward. I don't, with Jafar, I don't know if they even know how controversial this was back in the day. I don't even know if they know that, I mean, maybe just the Overton window has just shifted because of Spin Ghoul. I have no idea.
Can I take you back to something you said a moment ago that leapt out at me on the Jafar case? I guess this had been reported, but the top prosecutor in that case has been removed, fired? What's the deal?
Yeah, well, the U.S.
that?
Attorney was fired, which you know, right. Eric Siebert, but then the assistant U.S. attorney, a guy named Michael Ben-Ari, was fired Wednesday. Because some MAGA person named Julie Kelly, I guess I kind of vaguely know she exists, tweeted that she guessed that he was part of the resistance to the Comey prosecution, which there's no evidence that he was, and he doesn't even work in that division of the U.S. Attorney's Office. And anyway, he was fired. And he, you know, like Martin Luther, puts a letter on his door saying that his termination hurts the case against Jafar, and that the Justice Department leadership is more focused on going after the president's perceived enemies than they are in protecting the American people. A very stark warning and very unlike what we're here. I mean, that is,
you know, that's the kind of thing we used to call a story.
Yeah. Well,
like, that's like really significant.
It is.
A terrorist who killed Americans in Afghanistan and the prosecution is upended.
Yep.
Because the top guy gets fired because he's not sufficiently politically loyal. I mean,
I don't even know that it's even true that he's not sufficiently politically loyal. Like, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, I covered it when it happened and I covered, you know, and I wrote about it for The Atlantic and I'm going to talk about it every time chance I get, but I agree. Like, why isn't that the lead of NBC Nightly News or whatever? I don't know. I don't know. I can't say. It's shocking to me though, because I think one of the reasons why it might not be as big a story as the four of us probably think it should be is because I don't think people understand how important a good prosecutor is to actually convict these guys. Like, it's not a gimme. It's not easy. Confessions get thrown out of court all the time. Who knows what the hell the Pakistanis did to this guy before the Americans got hold of him. I mean, Jafar. And this type of thing, the George Toskuses of the world, the Michael Ben-Aris of the world, like, these are people you want in those rooms, even if they're not cooperating with the media, like, making sure these cases are as tight as possible. And when I say tight, I mean, like, and the evidence is airtight and can't be thrown out on constitutional grounds by a judge, which is a very real possibility. We saw it happen with Galani. Toskus worked on a case in like 2003 of these Hutu maniacs who killed a bunch of Westerners in Rwanda, I think, at like some chimpanzee safari. And the case was thrown out because the judge said that the Rwandan interrogators were from the Tutsi tribe. She didn't have confidence that it wasn't torture when they confessed. And those guys are now free in Australia. And that, I mean, this is what experience is, right? It's not just a lifetime of successes. It's a lifetime of failures and successes. And you learn more from the failures. And so George Toskus is like, I'm never going to let that happen again, ever. And, you know, that's why you want a guy like that at the National Security Division of the Justice Department to make sure that every, you know, all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted and these guys, these terrorists go away forever and don't end up free men in Australia.
You used the phrase, they had to draw to an inside straight. Yeah. I thought that was a good description of their challenge in bringing this guy to justice. I was also just thinking in your dialogue over the Justice Department and so on in regard to Spin Ghoul. You got enough material here for a new season of Law and Order, Law and Order terrorism justice.
Seriously, you could do that. I mean, as you guys know better than I, like, the terrorism prosecutions are fascinating and fraught, and also because so much of the evidence is often classified. You know, you need to have a special closed door hearing. You guys know all about this, but a SEPA hearing where the defendant isn't even allowed to be in the room because of how they're introducing the evidence. And that was also part of the case against Spin Gul, like how they proved, and it had to do with his conspiracy to blow up the U.S. embassy in Nigeria.
Right.
But like his communications with a terrorist named, well, there was Abu Rahman, and then there was another one named Mohammed Shafa. But like, you know, in the world of spy talk, and like, you don't, it's not out in the open with Sam Waterston arguing it. It's behind closed doors, and nobody knows what they're saying.
So just another bead on the importance of experienced prosecutors. I did a little Googling, and it looked like most of the prosecutors who are the heroes of your story have all left.
Yep.
Justice. I think there's one, maybe Castor is still there.
I think Joe Castor's there, and Melody Wells, I think, is there. Okay. But most of them. Now, I don't think that has anything to do with anything other than having families and wanting to make more money and provide better for their families. I don't think it's a statement
about families.
Anything.
Speaking of families, there's so many stories inside your book. You know, you're telling the story of Spin Gul. You're telling the story of the investigative route. You're telling the story of the servicemen who were there. You're telling, you know, but you decided to bring in the family members, which were actually important to the trial as well. Can you talk about why and how and the difficulties, even though they were suffering after this traumatic event, the difficulties of that the prosecutors had in talking to them and what they wanted from them?
I had a little bit of the same experience that the prosecutors did, except, you know, they were trying to bring somebody to justice and I was just trying to tell the story. But as you know, asking people about the worst day of their lives is too often what people in journalism have to do and is difficult to do. The prosecutors, there's one particular soldier who was, I think he was the first one wounded or one of the first ones wounded, that the prosecutors had difficulty tracking down. They finally track him down at some rural place and location, like a trailer in Arizona. And the U.S. attorneys or the assistant U.S. attorneys and the FBI agents get into a disagreement about whether or not they should call him as a witness. The FBI agents are like, you can't call him. Like, he's a mess. He's emotionally fragile. You can't do it. And the assistant U.S. attorneys, they're basically saying, like, we won't call him if we can avoid it. But like, if we have to, we have to. Yeah, I mean, writing the book, it was very important to tell the story of the two men that were lost, because I thought, first of all, that's what you can do in a book or in written journalism that you can't really necessarily do with day to day, just like so-and-so was killed in Afghanistan journalism, where you're just giving his name, age, and the city of his origin. So that was important. But I also just want like the emotional pull of, this is what they were fighting for. This is why the prosecutors and the FBI agents were doing what they were doing. And one of the guys, Jared Dennis, who was killed, who was 19, Native American kid from Antlers, Oklahoma, was a sweet kid, and he would write home or call home and talk about how the Afghans were really not that different from us. And instead of branding their animals, they would dye them. And he thought it was so funny. Like, here's a pink chicken in this small village in this remote corner of Afghanistan. And one of the FBI agents kept a photograph of a pink chicken on her desk just to remind her of what she was fighting for, why she was working so hard on this prosecution. And some of the most moving moments for me as a reporter were talking to the people who went through this or people who lost their loved ones. To me, the most important, the moments that stick out to me are, one is a guy named Doc Simmons. He's the, obviously the medic. Every medic is nicknamed Doc. Doc Simmons is also kind of like the spiritual guide for the men of Firebase Skin. And he has a picture on his, like an illustration on his kit, on his medic kit, of Jesus and like a Roman. It's not, it's like a modern version of a Roman, but it's there to remind him that he's there to serve all of God's children, not just Americans. So if he encounters an Afghan who's wounded, even an Al-Qaeda who's wounded, he's there to help that person. But after the ambush, it's so traumatic for him. He rips it off his kit because the ambush has changed his heart. So that was really moving to hear and share that story. And another one is kind of the opposite message, which is there's a guy named Renly Dennis, who's Jared Dennis's brother.
So I was gonna say, yeah.
Yeah. And Renly Dennis reads a book, just randomly sees this book in the Antlers, Oklahoma, Barnes and Noble, written yeah. by this guy whose wife was killed in the ISIS attack on the Bataclan music hall in Paris. And it's called You Cannot Have My Hate. And it's basically based, it's this guy talking about how his wife and the mother of his child were killed by ISIS, but he's not going to give in to what the men of the terrorists of ISIS want him to do. He's not going to be devoted to his rage. He says, you can't have it. And Renly finds it very moving, and it inspires him when he gives his victim impact statement at the end of the book. And basically, he basically forgives Sven Gul. He basically says, like, I feel bad for you. And you can't have my hate. And like, it's just this very, like, I don't know that I would ever be capable of such a thing. It moves the judge so much. He has to like take a moment in his chambers to collect his thoughts. And it's just, these are the real men and women who make up this war on terror. And we forget it sometimes because we get so caught up in the intrigue and the prosecutions and such. But, you know, there are real people with real stories whose emotions are unpredictable and fascinating.
And one reason that's so important is in your book is that when you think about the 9/11 trial, which we talked about in a recent podcast, one of the things that a lot of people say is the reason it's so bad that we haven't had a trial is that there's a healing process that happens with a trial, that you hear what happens, it's vetted, you get to make your victim impact statement, you get to really, you know, internalize what's happened and feel like that's part of what it means to say justice is being meted out. And I think you show that really beautifully in your book with that last you know, episode that you talk about.
It's and for the men who served at Firebase, again, I should just say men and women, because there were MPs there who were women too. You know, it's not just the ones who were physically wounded or killed that day. All of them, like two of the victim impact statements are given by people who did not have any physical wounds from that day. But one of them, Master Sergeant, is talking about how his marriage fell apart because he always blamed himself for the two men getting killed. Another one talks about how his own sisters had to take him aside and confide and admit to him that they were terrified of him. They thought he was going to do violence to them or to himself. I mean, like, it has huge impacts on people. And, you know, that's why I write these books, honestly, just because we all cover them from the safety of our couches or whatever, even though maybe sometimes we get embedded and go abroad. But generally speaking, I mean, the glibness with which this country sends men and women off to danger to ruin their lives forever, potentially, is disappointing.
Yeah.
All this is a reminder, Jake, that great stories begin with great characters. And what we've got here is essentially a police procedural. It was marked by, driven by kind of a detective story.
Yeah.
And that's one of the many elements that makes it such a good read. So I hope the people will pick up Race Against Terror. Give it a good read. It's well worth your time for serious scholars of justice and terrorism, as well as just people who like a good read.
So. Thank you so much. Yeah, I wrote it. I wrote it differently from previous nonfiction books. I've written a few novels, as you know, and the lessons I learned while writing those novels about propulsive writing and making sure people are like, really just like brought you, grab them and you drag them with you on a story and have as little fat, if any, you know, probably hopefully no fat in the book at all. I tried to do that as much as possible, take those lessons and write it like a thriller, even though it's nonfiction.
You're a great storyteller, Jake.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming on the Spy Talk podcast. We could go on and on because there's so many fascinating.
Thank you so much.
Yes, we can.
To the story.
And happy birthday to Zach.
And to Jack.
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
see you
Dave.
Around.
See you guys. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't done so already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. And so that's it for now. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isagoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
We'll see you next time.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. MSW Media.
Hey, it's Jody Hamilton.
And Sean Smith-Pierce.
Here's a taste of what you might have missed from the Politics Bar.
Jody, I was listening to you this morning, filling in for Steph. You and Chris were debating, and just for the record, Jody is right. I mean, Chris's argument is that there is some truth to what's being said about the left being in their own information silo. Right.
Basically, we started talking about how Gavin Newsom has invited people on his podcast, high up MAGA guys.
Yeah. Well-known right-wing propagandists. That's what they are. Yeah.
And my argument is he shouldn't be inviting them because nobody on that side is listening to Gavin Newsom.
Right. It doesn't help to bring propagandists into a sphere where truth matters because they're just going to lie their asses off anyway.
Right.
So here is a public service message for Chris Lavoie. Jody Hamilton is right. Catch all that and more weeknights at the Politics Bar, available through your favorite progressive radio station, your favorite podcast player, or online anytime at thepoliticsbar.com.